Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, today there are more than 70 virtual currencies in the marketplace. You might have heard of some of the biggest players: Bitcoin, Ripples, and Litecoin, taking out the middleman and reinventing the meaning of money. The ad idea is gaining momentum among college students. On today's program, we hear how virtual money is opening doors for young Michigan entrepreneurs. Then, school districts around the nation, certainly right here in Michigan, are talking about ways to accommodate transgender students. The ACLU of Michigan's LGBT project is already working on model policies, and we'll take a closer look later in the hour. But first, the endless winter is dragging on and dragging on. And now we are really seeing what it's done to our roads. Patching crews trying in vain to keep up with a bumper crop of potholes. More and more of us losing tires, blowing suspensions as we slam into one of these gaping potholes. And keep in mind, Michigan's roads were crumbling before this winter. Well, with more winter to go, we wondered, where do our roads stand and what needs to happen in Lansing to do what it takes to repair and maintain our roads? We're joined now by someone who knows all too well just what this winter has done to our pavement, Michigan Department of Transportation Director Kirk Steidel. Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
You started with MDOT, I saw, in 1987, and you grew up in Michigan, so you know about Michigan winters. But can you put into context for us just how hard has this winter been on our roads?
You know, this winter has been just unbelievably unrelenting through, you know, these last cold spells, and then what we're headed into here the next couple of days with this warm-up. As you said, I've grown up in Michigan, so, you know, we frankly are probably having a winter like most of us remembered as kids.
Yes.
With the big snowbanks. I know the kids in my neighborhood are playing a lot like I used to when I was a kid.
Right.
The difference is, from a road network, we had a much newer and stronger road network when I was younger, you know, a long time ago. And what's happened over the last, say, 20 years, particularly the last 10 or 12, is we've been falling behind in making those long-term repairs that we need to make. And it's largely because we've not funded it adequately within the state. You know, there's road agencies that are across the state that are trying to stretch their dollars as far as they can, and they've got, you know, a whole network, miles and miles of roads that they're trying to hold together. So in many cases, they end up putting on a shorter-term repair because they're trying to just keep things together instead of letting something completely go. And I think what you're seeing right now is the ramifications of those kind of decisions for over the past decade of essentially chronic unfunding.
And basically using Band-Aids.
Yeah, basically using Band-Aids. And it was just a report that came up from the U.S. Census Bureau that showed Michigan as 50th, last in the country in per capita spending on our roads. So it shouldn't be a surprise to any of us as to the condition that they look in. We don't put our money where our mouth is. If we really want good roads, we have to pay for them. There's a saying I like to use. It says, good roads cost money, but bad roads cost more.
There you go. And we're seeing that. Everybody's talking about the potholes. And behind all of that is something that it's frost heave. What does that mean, and what happens?
Sure. So yeah, that's a great question. You know, as people drive down the road, and right now they're probably 90% of the roads that they're on, they have these look like speed bumps that are in the middle of the road. And it doesn't matter if it's a county road or a city street, or and it's even popping up on some state highways. Those bumps were not there 3 or 4 months ago, and they won't be there in about 3 or 4 months. And what's happening right now is there's water down below that is frozen, and it's expanded, and it's lifting up the pavement right where that bump is. And then what happens when you put salt on the road and we get a little bit of warm temperature, things warm up on top and a little bit more water seeps into that crack and it expands. So those little frost bumps continue to grow over the winter, and the only way they go away is when the weather warms up and that water runs away from the base of the pavement. So it's going to, you know, they're all going to go away.
Yeah.
The critical part for us is, how does it warm up? And if it warms up and goes through that, you know, 35 to 40 during the daytime and back down to 20 at night, then we're going to melt the snow on top or the ice that's right below the pavement, and then it's going to freeze again at night.
And then
it's going to melt. and freeze.
And repeat and rinse, right?
Right, exactly. And that's when they talk about the freeze-thaw cycle, that's it exactly. So what's happening to that pavement is it's going up and down and up and down and up and down, and then cars are hitting it, boom, 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 boom. And then where each of those little tents is at, you know, little tented-up joints, is where we're going to probably have a pothole, probably in the next month to 6 weeks.
I'm speaking with Michigan Department of Transportation Director Kirk Steidel, who has quite a sobering story about the conditions of our roads. If you were a teacher, Kirk, what grade would you give to Michigan's roads today?
Very poor. Probably not passing.
Like in the D range?
Yeah, probably in the D range. I'd try to stay away from letter grades, but that, you know, they're not very good.
Yeah.
And it's largely because we've got to invest in them to take care of them. Wishful thinking doesn't do it, right? We actually have to spend money if we want them to perform differently and perform better.
So what I'm hearing is we were already hurting, and now that this winter has slugged us so badly, boy, oh, boy. I mean, I read where MDOT budgeted about $88 million for highway maintenance for fiscal year 2014. I have to imagine this winter has really blown a hole in that budget.
Yeah, actually, that $88 million is just for the winter. So that's what we spend across the state. That's what we budget for. It's a five-year average of what the winter storms are. It's about $88 million, and that's for all the state trunk lines in the state, whether it's an I route, a U.S. route, or an M route. And this year, we're projecting that we will be probably close to $39 million over that $88 million by the time we're done.
Which means you have to ask for more money.
Yeah, we have to ask for more money, what really usually happens is we have to take it out of the summer budget. Well, in this case, we're already spending the summer budget, and so we are asking the legislature for some additional consideration to help across the state with that maintenance budget because it's been so bad. I mean, otherwise, we basically will do nothing in the winter. We won't have any money, or in the summer. We really won't have any money to mow the grass or pick up the trash or fix the guardrail or even the signs that get knocked down. Because there just won't be any staff hours left and any money to buy materials or anything else that we need.
Well, we all know in Michigan that a year ago, Governor Snyder called for more than $1 billion in new road funding, but then no one in Lansing could agree on a way to raise that money. This time around, the governor's budget includes that $254 million in one-time general fund money for road and bridge improvements, not a long-term revenue mechanism. So what does that mean from where you sit as MDOT director?
Sure. That's a great question. And actually, the governor's budget message spent actually quite a bit of time still laying out the fact that we have to have this longer-term solution. Now, what he proposed was putting $250 million of general fund money into the transportation budget, which would be the third year in a row and the third year in history that we've put general fund money into the transportation budget, which is largely funded with your state gas tax, your 18 cents a gallon, and your state registration fees. The sales tax that you pay at the pump does not go into the transportation budget. That goes into the general fund or goes into school aid and revenue sharing for cities and counties. So what the governor did was put $250 million into the MDOT budget to help us with our match to the federal government and to put money specifically into maintenance. He called for a $40 million increase in the maintenance budget alone. So that's really substantial.
And what kind of signs are you getting from lawmakers as far as how this is going to play in the legislature?
Well, I think a lot of lawmakers are seeing exactly what your listeners are seeing. They're seeing potentially the worst breakup in our memory, and they're seeing that we've got to do something. So there is a lot of attention. In fact, a lot of their constituents are really beginning to make the phones ring at their representative's office and said, look, you have to deal with this. You have to do something. So a lot of them, I think, are looking at much more earnest of what the governor proposed, and I think now they're realizing that he was right. He was on the right path. He's still on the right path, and hopefully we're going to get to some longer-term solution here, you know, shortly. I don't know if it's going to be this year, it's going to be after the election, it's going to be the beginning of the first term, but whatever it happens to be, or the next term in 2015, whatever it happens to be, we've got to deal with this long-term problem. You know, in 2008, the legislature and the former governor passed and initiated a transportation funding task force that looked at all of these issues in 2008 and said, we really need to double our investment. That was in 2008, and none of those recommendations have been put in place. And so it's not new.
No, and for for years and years, there seems to be this back and forth at in Lansing over road funding. Do you think the roads are now bad enough that Michigan drivers would accept a higher gas tax?
Well, what was interesting was the recent poll that came out that showed voters certainly recognize there's an issue with transportation funding and want money to fix the roads. I don't know that specifically said gas tax or registration fees or whichever.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is there's really only a couple of ways to pay for transportation. You either pay for a gas tax, you pay a registration fee, or you use toll roads, which we don't have any and would be very difficult to institute, or you use general fund money. Those are really the four mechanisms you have. And what I've said is if people don't like one of those mechanisms, that's fine. Just realize you took one off the table. So that's possible. But, in the end, nobody likes paying extra fees for anything. I don't either. But we get what we pay for. And right now we're getting what we've paid for the last 10 or 15 years.
Kirk Steidel, director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Kirk, thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Up next, how to succeed in the music business without leaving Michigan. Producer and U of M student Arjun Singh talks about teaming up with local and national talent to make electronic pop with wide appeal in his new EP, The Drift. That's up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name is Arjun Singh. He's a 24-year-old student at the University of Michigan. Arjun Singh has teamed up with former U of M student Michelle Shamuel to release an EP that's called The Drift.
Sometimes in life, small things give light, hold you and feed you like a fire.
And if that name and voice ring a bell, it should. Michelle Shamuel came in second on season 4 of The Voice. And now comes an EP called The Drift with Arjun Singh as producer. And with virtually no promotion, this EP hit number 2 on the iTunes electronic charts. Arjun Singh, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, you and Michelle have been working on this project since before she really grabbed America's attention on The Voice, yeah?
Yes.
And how'd you connect?
It's really not an impressive story. I was at her friend, his name is Tyler Duncan. I was just working on some music at his house, and I just asked him, like, hey, like, where's this singer? What's up? What's she up to these days? And he was like, you know, she's at home. She's in. She's back out in the East Coast. So I was just like, hey, can I get her email? Like, I'd love to talk to her. And that was it. Like, I emailed her. I said, hey, you know, you don't know me, but I was working with Tyler and I asked about you. And that's how I got your email. And I would love to work with you. Here's some music. Check it out. And that same day, she sent me back a song, which is actually on the EP, which is Avalanche. And she actually wrote that whole record, you know, the core idea, like in a matter of a few hours. She recorded it on her computer and sent it right back.
And she's a producer, a composer, and a vocalist. And you're a producer and composer.
Yes.
But you were able to fit all of that together easily?
Yeah, it was just kind of a natural fit. But yeah, she wears multiple hats where she can kind of do everything. Me, I just wear one hat. And I just put all my energy into that, which is just being a producer, which is just kind of, you know, your job as a producer in music can be kind of vague.
I'm curious, what do you hope this EP says about you as a producer, and especially a producer who's based in Michigan?
I think that the thing that it says the most is when you listen to it. What's cool about this project is that it's just a different type of music that you haven't really heard come out of Ann Arbor. It's more top 40. It's not very folk-driven. Mm-hmm. And I'm a fan of that music as well. It's just a different look for the area. And I think when people listen to it, they can be proud of it because it's something that, you know, usually like big labels would probably put a lot of money into to make it with, you know, writers that are in L.A. or New York. And this is something that was made without a label. It was made purely independently. It was released independently. And, you know, we mixed and mastered it, you know, without any middlemen. And it's if you play it with top 40 music, it's very competitive with that style. So I think that's the best thing about that project.
We're talking with producer Arjun Singh about the new EP called The Drift. And what does it say to all of us about the talent pool in Michigan?
There's a lot of talent here. That's all you have to know. Like, it's just not it kind of gets overseen because there's a lot of hardcore talent. And that talent's a part of this project. Like, again, you know, Tyler Duncan was an engineer on this. A friend of mine, Nick Nagurka, who recently graduated from U of M at their engineering school, he helped me mix one of the tracks. Chris DuPont, who's a local artist, helped with the guitars on one of the songs. It's called Drift. And again, you know, that song Drift features Isaac Castor.
In fact, we should say right now, the title track of The Drift features rapper Isaac Castor of Saline High School. And he's with us here now. How did you cross paths with Arjun to wind up on this EP?
Well, I was originally contacted by a mutual friend named DJ Graffiti, who's one of the like more bigger hip-hop DJs in the area, who also is now doing other business ventures. But he sent me this song. It was a sample of White Flag by Dido, and was, hey, this guy Arjun Singh, you've probably never heard of him, but this guy's got mad talent. You really need to check it out. And I was like, all right, because I hear this all the time from people trying to get me in touch with their friends. So I listened to the song, and it blew me away. It was such a good use of the sample. And we ended up, it went on my last album, which came out of September 2012. It's called Young and Restless. It was the last track on the album. And ever since then, we kind of been in touch, and then I want to say August of 2013, he hit me back up and said, hey, I'm working on this EP with Michelle Shamuel. And, of course, that jumped right out at me. And I was like, yeah, well, of course I'm interested.
Sign me up.
Yeah.
Do you catch my drift? Do you catch
my... You've been on my mind every single second since the day you've been gone. To the rise of the moon from the crack of the dawn. I know neither one of us admitting that we're wrong. Ain't nothing left for me to do but put it in a song now. Feels like I've been on Castaway stranded. Always running back to you, believing empty handed. On a higher plane now, but don't think I can land it. Who'd have ever thought you'd be the one I took for granted?
So you are able, because of technology, to be able to be still in high school and make this all happen right in Saline?
That's what's crazy about the internet, is there's so many more resources now that are available to me. Like, if I tried to do this in the 90s or the 80s,
yeah,
or even probably 10 years ago, it would not be as easy. Like, it's just, you know, with all the social media out there, I can reach out to virtually any producer I want to work with, and they might not reach back out to me, but it's pretty crazy in that way.
Kids in his demographic aren't turning on Top 40 radio. They have their iPad or their iPhone, and they just search what they want.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is now, like, you're not – when you develop your tastes, usually what happens is you kind of do it in a form of grouping. You know, if you've grown up on like adult contemporary, you tend to kind of look at everything from that perspective, from that style of music.
Like a filter.
Right. But now I actually have a belief, and it's a strong one, that I think that kids today have a better taste of music, a more like evolved taste of music mm-hmm. than people who are older, because they're listening to everything across genres. And it could be folk, it could be country, it could be hip-hop, it could be dance.
And it's not through the decisions of a program director at a radio station
right.
Or an A&R guy from a record label who decides right. to sign. You can just find anything you want.
Exactly.
Plunge through the internet and
exactly.
there it is. Isaac, do you feel like you are a Michigan rapper in the sense when people talk about Eminem? First thing that kind of comes out, no matter where you are in the world, is they know Eminem's
exactly.
from
Detroit. Exactly. And even Eminem relocated when Dr. Dre, you know, told him, you got to fly out to L.A. to work with me. And that's what's unfortunate is that we don't have the same crowd or audience, rather, that the two major markets like L.A. and New York have.
Well, what about Southeast Michigan?
Southeast Michigan in general, yeah. I think that's my goal is what he was saying, to stay in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Weather aside, I'd still like to move somewhere else just because I'm sick and tired of this cold. But yeah, if we could stay put right here, and just because, like he was saying, we have so much talent and just the character values that the artists around here possess. Like, there are so many shady people in the music industry. Like, you know, I just feel like it's more wholesome around here. And I don't know, that might just be biased because I've lived my entire life in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. But I definitely see what he's saying.
It's interesting when you start talking about some of the folks you've worked with. And I happen to know you mentioned Tyler Duncan. And years ago, I encountered him as an Irish piper playing traditional Irish music. Jeremy Kittle has worked with Michelle Samuel, a Celtic fiddler. But it doesn't matter anymore, does it? We had Asher Perkins on Stateside March of last year. Traditional Irish music and also electronic. So the boundaries and the borders aren't there the way they used to be?
No, I mean, the world is just flat now, you know? Like, a lot of the, as cliche as it sounds, a lot of the red tape is gone. Like, if you're a musician now, this is the best time to be one. Because back in the day, if you wanted to do this, you needed access. You needed access to an expensive room where they had the gear. A regular person, even someone who's like, even like upper class, it's expensive stuff to buy. You know, a couple of these tape machines, a board, you're looking at some serious money. And so now you download some software or you go to, you know, a guitar center, you get a couple tools. Even, you know, your iPhone, your iPad now have just, they have, you know, like GarageBand apps and you can start making music. It's actually really democratized now. And at the same time, like there's also so much information now and so many resources that there's really never been a better time to just follow your passion because the resources are everywhere and they're at the touch of a button, you know, and there's no one in your way to stop you from getting at them.
U of M student Arjun Singh is the producer. He has teamed up with former U of M student Michelle Samuel, releasing an EP called The Drift, and featured on the title track of The Drift was my other guest, rapper Isaac Castor of Saline High School. Pleasure to meet both of you and good luck with the EP. It's available on
iTunes.
iTunes. Yep. Again, speaking of democratizing music, and there it is. It's available on iTunes. Thank you so much for talking with
Thank
us
you.
On Stateside.
Thank you.
Didn't think I'd find you once again. Always gonna find you at the end. And if you need a head start, be my guest. If you wanna hide now, go ahead.
National leaders are recognizing Detroit's food movement. Last week, it was announced the federal government's providing $150,000 to support local food cultivation in the Detroit area. The money will mainly go to urban farmers in the city to help fund infrastructure for growing crops. Detroit really has become a hub for urban farming, but the city is also home to a host of hidden and amazing restaurants and bars. So let's take a tour of some of these places with writer Bill Loomis. His book is Detroit Food, Coney Dogs to Farmers Markets. So when I say the words Detroit food, you say?
What I've kind of concluded talking to people is it's a warm feeling of slow-cooked food. Not exotic, pot roasts and veal shoulders, but there's also other influences like soul food has become a big thing. Jewish food, corned beef, some of the best in the United States comes in. Ethnic influences like Greek, Polish, of course, Ukrainian, Hungarian foods. And then also another aspect that's been kind of dismissed lately or forgotten a little bit is Great Lakes fish. If you look at old menus from places in Detroit, fried perch, smelt, lake trout,
wonderful
walleye,
whitefish,
yeah. Absolutely. Those are all part of Detroit food.
You really give us a real good sense in your book, Detroit Food, Coney Dogs to Farmers Markets, of the people behind Detroit food, the chefs and the bakers and entrepreneurs and urban farmers. And what do these folks have in common?
That's a good question. They're coming from all over. It's not just Detroiters. You meet people from Arizona. There's quite a contingent of people from Toronto and Canada. Usually, the advantage of food is that it doesn't take a lot of money to get started into food. So that, from a practical standpoint, a lot of people are drawn to Detroit because they can have a restaurant for about a tenth the cost that it would be to open one in Toronto or New York or something like that.
Or probably even the suburbs of Southeast Michigan.
Yeah.
Like yeah.
But these are people that are also very mission-driven. These are not people that are going to open a Dairy Queen in Troy. They see this as a much deeper activity than just making pickles. This is a mission, like I say. Mm. They're in sometimes what I considered fairly sketchy neighborhoods.
And do the customers come anyway?
They do. A lot of people, let's say the Woodbridge Pub or some of the places in Corktown, they get most, if not many, of the people are from the neighborhood. They're neighborhood people. But they get a lot of people, more and more people coming in from outside of Detroit. If you go to some of these neighborhood places, you see people in suits, you see people in medical, scrubs
yeah.
and things like that. All kinds of people are coming in.
Well, Bill, you show really clearly about how much the efforts of one restaurant owner can matter to a neighborhood, a real ripple effect. And I'd like, if you would, to ask you to read to us from your book, Detroit Food. And this excerpt is about Jim Geary, who had been in Ann Arbor and felt something was lacking, right? And he came to Detroit in late 2006, and he bought a crummy rundown building at Trumbull and Merrick Streets and transformed it into the highly successful Woodbridge Pub.
Yeah, that's right. And he came from a farm originally. He's a farm boy. Who came into the city. But, yeah, let me read this section. Early on in the pub project, Jim realized the importance of the neighborhood to its success. As he said, you cannot operate a business in a crime-ridden, litter-strewn setting. The city offered nothing, so he took it on himself. Who's going to do this? He asked himself. I learned that the best help I could offer Detroit was to take care of my little corner myself. I'd take care of my street. He began by keeping the sidewalk at the pub clean from litter. He mowed the vacant lot across the street, eventually buying it to keep it cleaned. Soon others in the neighborhood turned it into a community garden. Jim shovels the snow, not just at the restaurant, but throughout the neighborhood as well. His restaurant staff members, who know Jim's commitment, go down the streets trimming trees of overhanging branches. We take pride where we live. It's not gentrification, he added. The recession in the mid-2000s was actually a good thing. The neighborhood has a long history of diversification, economic and racial. While once in an elite area, the home of Ty Cobb and George Booth and others, it fell into neglect during the Depression and many homes were subdivided for workers, later for Wayne State University students. The recession of 2000 slowed down the money that dries up home prices and drives many people out of the area. This didn't happen. While the restaurant is a success, Jim continues to rehab houses. Bringing to life the neighborhood is a personal mission. It drives him. The crime problem has improved, but the fear of crime is a suburban mindset, Jim claimed. While there is crime, he and others don't think it's continual. You know, there are neighborhoods that are crime-ridden, but that doesn't mean all neighborhoods are crime-ridden. If something happens to people in the suburbs, they ask, why did this happen to me? Whereas people living in the city typically think, why was I so dumb to allow this to happen? Jim sees no need to expand, but he would like to see others open up on Trumbull. With his drive, they will.
And you say you heard this kind of thing over and over again. So they're like like a catalyst planted in the neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so much so that I had to sort of change tack because I kept repeating the same story. It's very similar. Many of the people are college educated. They come from very different backgrounds. But mostly they, like I say, they come from college background and somehow just didn't feel satisfied with what what path they were on. And this is what they've chosen.
Well, I have to say, besides getting a real good sense of the history of food, such as finding out why Detroit has Coney Islands and no one else does, that's in your book, Farmers Markets. But you also give us a lot of good ideas when we're sitting around going, what are we going to do Saturday night? A lot of options. Go to Cliff Bell's, go to Sugar House, and start exploring some of these wonderful old buildings.
Oh, yeah. It's not just the restaurant. It's the place that they're in. There's so many places. And a lot of the reason I wrote the book was I meet a lot of people in the suburbs or outside of Detroit who really don't know anything about Detroit other than maybe the Art Museum and the Tiger Stadium or America Park.
It's all right. Some of us still say Hudson's.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So in some ways it was to acquaint them with some of the activities down there, these new bars that are so much fun, just beautiful.
It's a great read and a good resource, as we said, for exploring Detroit and kind of eating your way around the Motor City. Writer Bill Loomis, his new book is Detroit Food, Coney Dogs to Farmers Markets. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Up next, as more and more transgender students come out, how should our schools support them? ACLU attorney Jay Kaplan will join us to walk us through model policy that's designed to help local school districts support transgender students and staff. And then how virtual money is opening new doors for young Michigan entrepreneurs. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just how far should a school go to accommodate transgender students? What federal or state laws and ordinances might impact policies for these students? School districts all around the nation are wrestling with these questions, even as parents and civil rights groups mount court challenges against districts whose policies are not supportive of transgender student rights. The ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project is now crafting a comprehensive model policy for transgender students, a policy that could be adopted by local school districts. Jay Kaplan is a staff attorney who is part of this effort. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Pleasure to be here.
So when we use that term transgender, what are we talking about, not just practically but legally?
Well, we're talking, it's a large umbrella term, and it refers to people who identify differently and who express themselves differently than the biological gender that they've been born with. And many times a transgender person, they find their biological gender to be incongruent with how they feel about themselves and how they would like to express themselves. As far as laws that cover transgender people, usually the category that we look at, it's called gender identity or gender identity and expression. And in Michigan civil rights laws, that category is not included. Sometimes we have to look to other protections that deal with sex discrimination. Some of our federal courts have held that when you discriminate against a transgender person, you're doing that based on gender stereotypes. You don't look, you don't act the way I think someone who's male or who was born male should look, vice versa with female, and therefore I'm going to deny you these opportunities. And the courts have held that that constitutes sex discrimination.
And is that Title IX, then, of the Federal Civil Rights Act?
It would be Title IX as it applies to education, mm-hmm. and it would be Title VII as it applies to employment. Yes.
Okay. And we also, we've got the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, but those in and of themselves are not enough, is what I'm hearing?
Well, I mean, you certainly can bring a challenge, but the Equal Protection Clause deals with the government, deals with a public school district, but mm-hmm. it doesn't deal with things in the private sector.
Okay.
And that's why you want civil rights laws.
So what you're doing in the project is to try to come up with this model policy. Is this the idea that you could offer this up to a school district and know that it would lead them on the path that would be doing the right thing for a transgender student and also following laws and ordinances?
We believe so, and the ACLU is working with a number of different individuals, educators, administrators, parents of transgender students, members of the transgender community, to develop a recommended policy that hopefully will provide guidance to school districts, and as you mentioned, hopefully they will consider adopting it, as a way to address, because what we're seeing is that transgender students are coming out more in school, and they're coming out at an earlier age. And I think it's helpful to have that guidance for schools with how they deal with situations like this, so that they have an understanding of what it means to be transgender, and they respond and they react appropriately.
Does the way a transgender student is treated in school districts in Michigan, does it vary by district? I guess I'm asking, are some districts more in sync with the needs of a transgendered student than others?
I would say anecdotally been pleasantly surprised in many instances how school districts have dealt with this in a very sensitive manner and have adapted very, very well. But I think, for other school districts, this is going to be a new thing, and it's going to be a thing that they're going to need some guidance and some important information in order to make the right decisions. I think whenever you have a policy that deals with transgender people, the first and most important thing is you have to have an understanding of what it means to be transgender and what a person who identifies that way, what is their life experience and what are the things that they need in order to effectively function and to feel that they are treated with their full worth and dignity.
So as you go through this process with the LGBT project and trying to design model policies, I'm sure you are coming up against many, many situations where the needs of a student bumps head on into the way a school wants to run things.
Well, I think it can. And I think, many times schools, they establish their policies and they haven't necessarily considered other contingencies. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you deal with someone who's transgender, you're dealing outside of the traditional gender binary, that we expect male and female and people are to act a certain way. So this kind of calls into question some of those established assumptions that don't necessarily fit. It's not a one-size-fits-all. So sometimes that can create resistance and it can create some questions. But I think when you just look at it in a practical sense, allowing someone to be who they are, as long as it's not substantially disrupting the regular carrying out of educational activities, which in for the most part it never is going to do that, it shouldn't be a problem for the schools.
I'm speaking with attorney Jay Kaplan. He's with the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project. They're working at crafting a comprehensive model policy for transgender students and hoping that this policy could then be adopted by local school districts. So I got to imagine right at the beginning, the most commonly experienced challenge comes down to bathroom use.
Absolutely, that's outside of the school setting as well. And basically, what we recommend, what we think is supposed to be the right policy, is that transgender students be allowed to use a restroom in accordance with their gender identity and their gender expression. many schools have adapted that way. Sometimes what they'll do is they will provide a single user, a gender-neutral restroom facility. And although that can be acceptable, I don't think this should always be the assumption that the transgender student has to be in a separate facility. I think a separate facility should be available to anybody who feels uncomfortable using a communal restroom. But let's face it, the purpose for restroom use is one purpose only.
Right.
And any other behavior going on in there by any student, regardless of gender identity or expression, that could be considered inappropriate. But we always advocate that the student be allowed to use the facility in accordance with their gender identity and expression.
What about dress codes? Now, we'll take apart the fact that you have private schools, parochial schools, that will and public schools, too, that you know, say, wear a uniform. Mm-hmm. So there's that, but especially when it's anything goes, what should a school try to do to accommodate their transgender student?
Sure. Well, I certainly schools can have dress codes, and they can decide what is the appropriate attire. But when you start having dress codes that specifically make reference to a particular gender and to say that only male students can wear pants to particular school events, or if you have other limitations on only female students can do that, that's not going to fit for the transgender student. Mm-hmm. So we would advocate that the transgender student be allowed to dress in accordance with their gender identity expression within the guidelines of a school dress code.
And how do you get through or over or around issues that parents of other students, especially if we're talking younger kids, when parents are really involved in classroom activities in a way that might not be the case in high school, how do you get them to see things through the eyes of the transgender student?
Well, hopefully through education and providing information for understanding. A lot of times when the problems do arise in these situations, it's based on fear of the unknown, fear due to lack of information. So I think the opportunity to provide, there should be nothing that another child should have to fear because they're with a transgender student. The transgender student is there for the same reason a non-transgender student would be there, to learn, to be educated, to feel comfortable in school, and to feel that they fit in and they can focus on their studies. And so these policies, these recommended policies and practices, are a way to help that student, that transgender student, be able to focus on their academics and not feel that they're an outcast or not feel that they cannot be themselves.
Jay Kaplan is with the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project, working on those very policies that he spoke of. Any sense as far as how long it'll take to get the policies, the model policies, crafted and out into the hands of school districts?
I don't think it's going to take too long because, to be honest with you, we're really not reinventing the wheel. There's been school districts across the country, states of California and Massachusetts and Seattle, all over, who've really crafted some pretty comprehensive and some good policies. So we're just kind of taking the best from each one and putting that together. Maybe in the next couple months we will have something. And what we'd like to do is just to make this available to school districts and to encourage them to take a look at it and considering adopting these policies.
Jay, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bitcoin. Is it something that could really alter centuries of banking and money practice? Or is it an unstable, funny money fad? Bitcoin's a digital currency or cryptocurrency. It isn't backed by any central bank. But my next guests are banking on Bitcoin. Kennard Hockenhull actually left the University of Michigan to set up a Bitcoin business he calls Bitbox. And Daniel Block is a U of M junior in LSA in engineering. He's working with Kennard on Bitbox, and he's going to launch his own Bitcoin-based nonprofit called CoinGive that tries to give charities a helping hand using Bitcoin. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, thanks for having us.
You know, you probably, both of you, get this all the time, and I think we should get everyone on the same page as we talk about Bitcoin and the businesses that you've set up. Kennard, tell us, how would you explain what Bitcoin is to someone who's never even heard the word before?
Right. So the explanations for Bitcoin sort of go in an onion form, in that the deeper you want to go, the more detail you can get. The shortest version is that Bitcoin is like digital gold, but that doesn't really tell you anything about how it works. So if you have money in the bank and you spend that money, mm-hmm. you can't go and spend the same money again, right?
Right.
That's because the bank has a list of every transaction, and it changes that list every time someone does a transaction,
sure.
spends some money.
Okay.
So what Bitcoin does is it takes that record keeping away from the bank, and it has it done by the network rather than a third-party institution. So what that
the
does
the network
is,
meaning who?
The network meaning everyone who's participating in Bitcoin.
Okay.
And so what that does is really enable for the first time global instant person-to-person payments, which is something we've never had before.
So if I'm in Russia and you're here in Ann Arbor, we can instantly do something. No transaction fees with banks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, via email, via phone. You're starting to see like very interesting adaptations. People are theorizing that a third of all Kenyan citizens use and own Bitcoins. And they've set it up with their mobile phone development, so it's easy to send via just your phone number. So I type in a friend's phone number, and I can easily send it away.
Mm-hmm.
And what Kunal was saying, going on the value of like how Bitcoin is related to virtual gold, is that the way you mine gold, you know, you go into a cave with shovels coming out, you know, getting
yeah.
gold,
yeah.
is the same theory as Bitcoin is proposed. And so all the Bitcoin is only a set amount. Like there's a set amount of gold. So as people are mining gold, gold is being worth more because, you know, supply and demand. So Bitcoin is kind of held in this virtual gold cave on the internet. So this digital gold. And so the same way you come in with shovels, you come in with virtual shovels in the form of your laptop, you know, at first.
Uh-huh.
And now it's become way more complex, whereas people have come into these, you know, gold caves with bulldozers. You know, it's a whole industry in itself. Is another part of what we do with Bitbox is we own these big computing machines that are specific computers just for mining Bitcoins.
So here's a cyber gold mine of Bitcoins. What do I do to earn Bitcoins?
So like kind of just say there's an entrance into the Bitcoin cave. And it's this is what runs how you get a Bitcoin and who doesn't get Bitcoin is by solving this really big math algorithm.
Okay, there
that
we
is
go.
Set up by Bitcoins. You could sit there and someone could originally have, you know, try to solve it by hand. That would take probably thousands of years. Then you could use your computer and your laptop, which is the first. So you would turn your computer. There's open software available.
Uh-huh.
Bitcoin software is all open source, meaning that pretty much all of it is open for the public to use. That you don't go and buy the Bitcoin software to down and okay. like and use it. You just it's open, available online. You put it on your computer, and how strong your computer is almost like how strong your bulldozer is in the virtual mind.
Huh. Are there businesses that are starting to say, okay, all right, Daniel, okay, Kennard, you can come pay us in Bitcoin. Is that happening?
There are actually some pretty notable businesses. I would say one of the biggest is Overstock.com and then Virgin Galactic too.
Shopify. And we're starting to see, I would say, like I call it like second tier online companies. So not Amazon, PayPal, Facebook mm-hmm. as of yet. But so the PayPal investors just put in a lot of money into Coinbase, which is the largest Bitcoin startup, one of the largest exchanges out of San Francisco. And we're in talk with a few different local restaurants in Ann Arbor. We like to say that Bitcoin is to money what email is to letters. Mm. And especially if anyone has ever used, when people are like, what's the point of, like, you know, how does Bitcoin have any advantages? And I, especially one thing I got really interested in when I used to have to send money a few times via Western Union. I don't know if you've ever done that.
Mm-hmm.
And Western Union nowadays seems like, you know, an archaic method is that, like, you know, we have the internet, we have access to online banking. Why am I taking cash to, like, Kroger and, you know, spending all this time? And, you know, and that really put things in perspective. And Kunal had told me about Bitcoins in 2011 and showed me the instant, you know, payment on the phone. And
Kunal, your view, why should someone consider using or accepting Bitcoin?
I think the thing that we always try to emphasize is that while Bitcoin is an amazing technological innovation that has tremendous improvements for merchants, for example, it removes the risk of chargebacks, which account for 10% of revenue losses mm-hmm. for American merchants and more if they're doing business globally, person-to-person transactions. But at the end of the day, I think the real thing that people have to understand is that Bitcoin isn't just money or a way to make money. It's a movement to change the meaning of money. And I think if they grasp that, then they start to really understand and see how the mechanisms of the currency really work. At the end of the day, value and currency are really belief systems. Right now, we have a system where only certain people can dictate how you can give, how you can create and transmit value. So largely it's a movement to try to return and restore value to the individual and the ability to create and transmit value to the individual. Yeah.
And it sounds like it certainly can provide opportunities for students who have an entrepreneurial spirit like both of you do.
For sure. I think that Bitcoin has excited a lot of young people because it really is an opportunity for them to enter a space that otherwise they wouldn't be able to. Mm. No one can really start their own financial services company because, you know, you have to get approval from SEC, FinCEN, there's a whole list of them. But I think one thing that I would like to say, having experienced it so far, is that there are actually lots of impediments. And I think that if we are going to really reap the harvest that should come from an innovation like Bitcoin, we have to be cognizant as a society of the fetters we're placing on entrepreneurs. And so for an entrepreneur like me, coming up with the $1 to $2 million that it would take to get licensed as a money transmitter in all 50 states is kind of absurd. Mm-hmm. And so much more so for all the other young people out there who are just getting started. So I think that's definitely something to keep in mind as a citizen.
Interesting thought as we learn about Bitcoin and talk to students involved. And as you say, this is not just on the campuses of Michigan or the United States, but around the world. We'll be watching about Bitcoin. Kennard Hockenholk, who created BitBox, and Daniel Block, who is launching CoinGive, bringing a charitable angle to this. Thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Tony Brown. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hadlesy, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.